Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who assesses the recent dramatic escalation of the Iraq War. Congressman Maxine Waters, who examines the U.S. role in the overthrow of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide and the continuing violence in that Caribbean nation. And Dudu Dlamini of South Africa's Treatment Action Campaign, who discusses her group's effort to bring life-saving drugs to millions of her fellow citizens now suffering with HIV and AIDS. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early March, Colombian President Alvaro Uribe traveled to Florida to meet with Governor Jeb Bush and business leaders. There, Uribe pledged that paramilitary groups were being disbanded and his country was eager to join the free trade area of the Americas Treaty. Earlier in 2004, Colombia was certified by the U.S. State Department for its human rights record and given $34 million in U.S. military aid. Yet just days before the certification, three peasants were killed by paramilitary forces in the disputed Cimarrara Valley region. An elderly man was found dead and a woman was also raped. In the oil-rich Arauca region, the Colombian army is actively working with oil companies to overcome opposition from indigenous groups. The major oil refinery in Barranca Bermeja is under military control. Last summer, an army battalion was put there, charged with protecting oil infrastructure from rebel attacks. But oil workers fear the soldiers are there to enforce Uribe's privatization plan for the state oil company Ecopetrol that union oil workers oppose. Local union president Juan Carlos Galvis commented by saying the army is there to pave the way for the FTAA. It is savage capitalism without a human face. Peggy Sidor has a simple but radical request to pray aloud at Judaism's holiest site, the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. Sidor is a member of the Women of the Wall, a campaign of dozens of Jewish women, Orthodox and Reform, who are seeking religious equality. They are challenging an ancient tradition that allows only men to wear shawls and pray aloud from the Torah at the Wailing Wall. The women also seek broader reforms in Judaism, which will grant them the right to be Orthodox rabbis. As Sidor observed, we say the Torah has at least 70 interpretations, so why not a feminist one that says we don't need men to represent us before God? According to the World Press Review magazine, Orthodox members of the Israeli parliament have drafted a bill making women who wear a shawl or pray aloud at the Wailing Wall subject to criminal charges and a 3-year jail sentence. In 2000, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that women have a right to pray and ordered that the then Labour government make it happen. But the government refused to force the Orthodox establishment to change its practices. Last spring, the Supreme Court again ruled that women could pray aloud, but designated a site away from the Orthodox rabbis. As Sidor declared, this court has rewarded the bullies. We want to be part of the larger public. She asks, why should we be hidden? As far back as 1942, Florida's U.S. Sugar Corporation was indicted for violating the constitutional ban against slavery. Sugar growers had long recruited black workers with the promise of free transportation and fair wages. But in reality, blacks from nearby states had to pay for their bus ride and were charged for room and board and had to buy the machete used to cut the sugar cane. In the early 1960s, growers transported seasonal workers in from Jamaica, Barbados and Haiti, but these migrant workers were only paid a piece rate and told they had to cut a ton of sugar cane per hour. According to the New Internationalist magazine, 300 sugarcane workers who went on strike in 1982 were quickly sent to the Miami International Airport and deported. For decades, sugar growers uprooted much of the Everglades to grow sugarcane with little thought of the damage done to the environment. Massive canals were built to drain the cropland that left much of the Everglades dry. The powerful sugar industry, which gave over $19 million in donations to federal candidates in the 1990s, has used its clout to shape the plan to restore the Everglades and protect the industry from cleanup costs. Last year, Florida Governor Jeb Bush signed a law that extends to 2016 the deadline for forcing growers to reduce levels of phosphorus, a destructive byproduct of sugarcane production. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Prue Cullen.
With intensifying combat in the Sunni Triangle and new attacks from a Shiite militia group, U.S. troops in Iraq are facing a dramatic escalation of violence and instability. In response to the killing and mutilation of four employees of a private security firm in Fallujah, American forces mounted a massive assault on insurgents in the city, which has become a symbol of resistance to the U.S. occupation. On a new and dangerous front, eight U.S. soldiers and dozens of Iraqis were killed in battles between American troops and members of a militia group loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The fighting broke out after the U.S. closed down Sadr's newspaper and arrested his close associates. In response, the militia group launched an uprising in six Iraqi cities. The U.S. occupation authority has since issued an arrest warrant for Sadr on charges connected to the murder of a rival cleric, but the Shiite leader's followers vowed to prevent his capture. Growing resentment of the American occupation in Iraq has led to an unlikely alliance of some Shiites and Sunnis now united in their calls for a withdrawal of U.S. troops. Despite the increasing violence and chaos, President Bush maintains that a transfer of power from U.S. authority to an interim Iraqi government will proceed as scheduled on June 30th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, a professor at the National War College and author of the book Bush League Diplomacy. Goodman assesses the dangers ahead for the U.S. military in Iraq, whose citizens are ever more hostile to continued U.S. occupation.
Well, the kind of conflict that we're facing is exactly what the critics of the war, starting over a year before the war began, warned about, and I was among those critics. And we argued two things, that you're entering an environment that the United States clearly does not understand. We're not very good at nationality problems. Problems involving ethnic politics and ethnic violence. There was a great chance that the country would break down into three parts, the Kurd part, the Sunni, the Shiites. The Kurds have been quiet because they're getting the kind of autonomy they want. But the Sunnis weren't going to go away quietly. Their livelihoods were really dependent on Saddam Hussein and a minority regime. And the Shias, who are clearly the majority, at least 65% of the population, were not treating the United States as liberators from day one. They were suspicious about our performance after Desert Storm when there was a serious Shia uprising and the United States didn't come to their defense. So I think they've been biding their time, and the catalytic agent for all of this is when the United States military very unwisely closed down a radical Shia newspaper that belongs to Sadr's group. And this, I think, just unleashed tensions that have been building. So now, in addition to serious Sunni resistance, good fighters who are well-trained, who probably were preparing all along to turn to a guerrilla struggle, which we are not good at dealing with, this requires a different kind of paramilitary training than the United States military is prepared for. The Vietnam experience in the 60s and 70s gives you all of the graphic evidence that you need. And now we're dealing with this large Shiite majority, 65%, who feel that if we're going to be talking about democracy, then a democratic regime is going to have a large and majority influence from the Shia community. The problem that presents for us is the Shias, if you look at their major religious leadership, most of them trained in Iran. They studied in Iran. And Donald Rumsfeld and the rest of the Bush administration certainly is not going to permit, even if it means they have to walk away from democracy, they're not going to permit a Shia government to emerge in Iraq that's going to have some kind of tie to the Iranian government. So we're in a classic no-win situation. This is a real Hobson's choice in terms of adding troops or reducing troops. The Bush administration has really done no planning for post-war, and they're now in a post-war situation that is out of control.
What are we likely to see unfold in the coming 7 to 8 months before the U.S. presidential elections? Is there the possibility of an all-out civil war between the various groups there, the Kurds, the Sunnis, the Shia? And is there any way that the United States could or should work to prevent that eventuality?
Well, the strongest adherents of the idea that there might be a civil war, interestingly enough, are the CIA people on the ground in Iraq. Now, over the past year, it's been done quietly, but there have been three different station chiefs, because as each CIA station chief, and he is the leading CIA official, comparable to, say, the American ambassador who represents the president of the United States, as they continue to predict the possibility of civil war, suddenly they're replaced, and a new CIA station chief goes out. The third one is there now in less than 10 months. He, too, believes that we were headed into a civil war situation. Paul Bremer, the leading American official on the ground, is very pessimistic in private. He's putting up a brave front in public, but his reporting back to Washington, I'm told, is extremely pessimistic. And now there's a great debate going on in Washington about whether or not we can really turn over authority on the 30th of June. Right now, the situation is so complicated that it's hard to say whether it will be a civil war or even the possibility of unity between Sunni and Shia if they decide to turn against the United States. The only prediction that I think is reasonable and fair and likely to happen, even in the short term, is greater violence. The Iraqis have lived under Saddam Hussein for the past 20 years. They feel they deserve something better, and they're not going to trade the tyranny of Saddam Hussein for the occupation and what they consider to be now the tyranny of the United States.
Many observers have noted that the timetable for U.S. transfer of authority to an interim Iraqi government on June 30th was driven in large part by the U.S. presidential elections. What are your concerns about these intervening months, and what kinds of reactions may come out of the White House to deal with growing violence in the interest of the White House reelection campaign?
Well, I fear two possibilities. The more I hear talk of overwhelming force and the more I hear talk of taking on insurgents, an enemy that's going to be very difficult to find, it means we're raising the risk of unnecessary civilian casualties and civilian deaths. And I think this would be counterproductive. This would only create more terrorists, more insurgents, and more opposition. The other thing that concerns me is in the opposite direction, that we'll move prematurely, move much too quickly towards sovereignty for the people of Iraq. Clearly, they're not ready for it, and with all this violence that we're seeing now, and with the United States sending signals that it wants out, the very Iraqi people that we're training on the ground, the police, the intelligence, the military people, who have now become targets of the Iraqi resistance, they don't see anything to be gained by cooperating with the United States at this particular time, because they know in the long run the United States is not going to be there, and whichever government authority emerges, it's going to look unfavorably on those people who cooperated with the United States. So I can't imagine a worse situation. We've created it to a great measure, and now I guess we're going to have to reap what we have sown in this case.
That was former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Contact the center by calling area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. After rebels led attacks against his government, deposed Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide charged that he was the victim of a political kidnapping carried out by members of the United States military. After being forced to leave Haiti, American soldiers and State Department officials flew the democratically elected president to the Central African Republic, where he remained until U.S. Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a Jamaican parliamentarian, and the former head of TransAfrica, Randall Robinson, chartered a plane to bring him back to Jamaica. President Aristide's call for an investigation and prosecution of those responsible for his overthrow has been supported by member nations of the Caribbean community, who thus far have refused to recognize Haiti's new U.S.-installed government. While U.S., French, Canadian, and Chilean troops patrol the streets of Haiti's cities, rebels have continued to attack and murder members of President Aristide's Lavalas party. Haiti's new Washington-installed Prime Minister, Gerard Latortue, raised fears of renewed violence when he praised the rebels that overthrew President Aristide as freedom fighters. Many of these men are convicted murderers and drug traffickers. Before Secretary of State Colin Powell traveled to Haiti on April 5th, 13 members of Congress addressed a letter to Mr. Powell asking him to extend the protection of the U.S. military to Lavalas Party officials, including the former prime minister, who have been attacked or threatened. Powell failed to respond, but said the U.S. was looking into prosecuting President Aristide on corruption charges. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Congresswoman Maxine Waters, a signer of the letter, who discusses her call for a congressional investigation into the U.S. role in the overthrow of President Aristide and her effort to prevent more bloodshed in Haiti.
I do have concerns about what is happening in Haiti under the new interim government. I really became alarmed when there was a rally and meeting held up in one of the northern cities of Haiti, Gonaïves, where Mr. Latour, the new puppet prime minister placed in by our government, held a moment of silence for one of the slain gang leaders, Mr. Metier. And in addition to that, he had on stage with him Mr. Guy Philippe, one of the so-called rebels, who really is ex-police chief from Haiti that tried to pull off a coup d'etat a couple of times, I think, before against President Aristide. When he was on the stage with them and held them as being freedom fighters, I knew that we certainly were in trouble with this so-called new government. This new government appears not only to be supportive of these thugs and these killers, but they are also turning a blind eye to the killing of members of the Lavalas political party. That's the party, Mr. Aristide's party. They're finding people dead every morning in the neighborhoods, in City Soleil and in Bel Air. They found people hands tied behind their backs and shot in the head, and it appears to be an attempt to get rid of the leadership of Lavalas. So Mr. Powell's visit there is simply to try to put a good face on this. I really believe it's out of hand. So I think that it's an unholy alliance that's been formed. Basically, what we have done in this country, along with Canada and France, OAS participation, and UN, is we have unseated a democratically elected president of Haiti, the CARICOM, that met in its intersessional meeting in St. Kitts a week or so ago, refused to recognize this government, and they're asking for an investigation by the UN as we are asking for an investigation in the United States Congress. So things are still quite in turmoil.
Where's your request and other congresspeople's request for an investigation headed? Is there a hearing set up? Is there any sense that there will be an in-depth investigation on Capitol Hill?
We need an investigation. We've asked for an investigation. I know that many of our members on the opposite side of the aisle do not wish to do it, but we're going to keep up the drumbeat until we get some answers.
Many reporters repeated the statements from the White House and the State Department that President Aristide was a failure as a president, that he was a thug, a murderer, and a corrupt politician. Address that, if you would, the veracity of their characterization of President Aristide.
When I went to Haiti January 1, I met with Andy Arpaio Jr. and members from the group of 184, the opposition. I met with business persons there. And, of course, I spent a lot of time with President Aristide and people from the Lavalas Party. What I said to the opposition was, when they said he was corrupt, they accused him of being involved in drug trafficking, they got so accusatory that one time they said, and do you know he beats his wife? And I just basically said, look, I've heard enough accusations. Explain it to me. Give me some proof. Tell me why you say that and what you know. To this day, I have not gotten an answer to that question. There are accusations that he did not do enough to alleviate poverty. Well, I don't need him to tell me why, but I know why. We have an embargo on any assistance to them. The money that we put into Haiti goes into non-government organizations, but it doesn't go into the infrastructure, into the government. It's one thing to say I'm going to help out a non-government organization because they're giving measles shots or they're helping kids, you know, get immunization, but it's another thing to have money to go into repairing the water system so they can have potable water. Kids are dying from polluted water. And so what you have is an infrastructure in great disrepair that cost a lot of money to fix, but we have an embargo against funding Haiti, and the World Bank left Haiti, and so did the International Monetary Fund. So I've not found any fact in any of the accusations, and I continue to ask, point to it, tell me, what do you mean? How did it happen? I just don't have anything. What I have is some of the same people who were responsible for the first coup d'etat. They didn't like the fact that President Aristide really was about democracy. They want things as the way they have always been in Haiti for so many years, with the rich and the powerful in absolute control, exploiting the poor people and extracting from them every ounce of labor they can get and paying them as little money as they can get away with.
That was California Congresswoman Maxine Waters. For more information, call her office at area code 202-225-2201 or visit her website at www.house.gov/waters. More people are living and dying with AIDS in South Africa than in any other country. More than a million have died so far, and hundreds of thousands of children have been orphaned. An estimated 1 out of 9 people over the age of 2 is infected. The impact of such statistics on the social and economic fabric of South Africa is almost unimaginable. In December 1998, the Treatment Action Campaign, or TAC, was launched to demand that the government of President Thabo Mbeki provide antiretroviral treatment for people with HIV/AIDS, including HIV-positive pregnant women. Mbeki's position had long been that poverty, not HIV, causes AIDS, and he appointed ministers of health who promoted their own unscientific theories and treatments. Under diplomatic and political pressure, the government pledged a rollout of antiretrovirals beginning April 1st, but later said the start date would be postponed until June because it would take that long to sign contracts with drug companies. In mid-March, TAC threatened to take the government to court to force implementation, and on April 1st, a limited distribution of drugs began for the most seriously ill AIDS patients. In late March, Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dudu Dlamini, treatment project coordinator with TAC, at her office in Johannesburg. She contracted HIV from her abusive former husband and gave birth to a baby who died of AIDS at the age of 2. She went public with her case in 1999 and began treatment in a drug trial that has restored her health. Dlamini spoke about the government's position on AIDS in light of upcoming national elections on April 14th and her hopes for tackling the disease in South Africa.
I think for our government, really, some of other things, they don't take everything serious. They were like negligent people. But now, because of this election thing, that's why now they're taking everything serious. We hope everything really is going to happen. As they say, this rollout, especially for adults, they are going to give the antiretrovirals on the 1st of April this year. But we hope really they can do that, because really people are suffering. You know, I don't know how many people that I lose, how many friends that I lose. Sometimes when I'm taking medications and see someone in need of treatment, just sometimes felt that maybe I can share. But knowing that I can make a mistake because I don't know the city for count of that person, and it's really hurt a lot. But we hope that our government has now has approved that really on the 1st of April, they are going to give the antiretroviral for those people who are in need. We wish that it can happen, really.
What is your hope for the future of South Africa dealing with the AIDS pandemic? I've read some research just in the last few days that make it sound like because the infection rate, the prevalence is so high already, that even if everybody got treatment tomorrow and there were no new cases, which of course is impossible, it would just be so devastating to the country, because most people are dying in the at the beginning or at the height of their economic and family responsibilities. So what do you hope for the country and as it deals with this issue?
What I think that will help to people is to reduce the discrimination, because people, they die because of discrimination. It's one thing that happens because they know that when you're just HIV positive, there's nothing that can help you. People, I think it will be like people who have cancer, who have sugar diabetic, because people don't know that I'm HIV positive, I need to treat this HIV so that it cannot kill me. But I think it will reduce. People, they will stand up and take care of themselves. If you talk of condom, just someone would just say, what is the use that I can use condom? Anyway, I'm HIV anyway. Let me die with others. People, they will take the responsibility of saying, let us take care of each other. I will use condom to prevent and to protect each other. They will see the need of using a condom. They will see the need of taking treatment. They will understand what is the treatment. No one will discriminate. No one will say bad things to those people who are HIV positive. Because I think even those people who are sugar diabetic, they are taking treatment for lifetime. It will be the same with antiretroviral drug and sugar diabetic people. No one will discriminate, because what make people to die like this is because of discrimination. People, they are scared to go to their clinics. People, they are scared to go to the hospitals because of the attitude that they get from the hospitals, the attitude that they get from the clinics. If I'm young, 15 years, 14 years, I don't think I'll be scared to go to the clinic and say I'm HIV positive. But now the STDs, I need to treat the opportunist infection during that time. No one would say things to me, even though that I'm young, because I mean, it's nature. We cannot stop people to have sex. It's one thing that happens, but I know if there is this treatment, HIV will reduce.
You said you went public with your status, and a few years ago, a woman who went public was murdered. How did you come to that decision? Was that a very frightening thing for you to decide to do? And what was the response?
For me to come out, really, what was it, the anger that I used to have. I didn't think of what will happen to me. That's why I think they hold that document. They didn't even take it out until they see that I'm really okay with that. Because they found out that there's an anger behind the disclosure. And even now, I'm not scared to call out and say things in public, especially if they think it can help people who are HIV positive. What I think the thing that can happen, really, if our government and our people can take it responsible, that as we are HIV positive, we're still human beings, we're still alive. We are people who can produce presidents, produce doctors. We can have children who are negative. There are many children who like born even today negative, but we say, you people take the responsibility of taking care of your neighbor. Each and every one that you see that she's HIV positive, make sure that that person is a human being.
That was Dudu Dlamini of the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa. For more information, visit the group's website at www.tac.org.za. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Prue Cullen, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.